After spending the past year scanning hundreds of thousands of sources on the internet, security company Recorded Future reports finding emails and passwords from government agencies lying out there. These credentials were connected to the Defense Department, Justice, and agencies across the intelligence community. Recorded Future is calling on agencies to beef up security by requiring two-factor authentication. Scott Donnelly is Director of Pre-Sales for Recorded Future. He joins me now with more. Mr. Donnelly, great to have you on.
Good morning, Tom. Thanks for having me.
All right, so you're Director of Pre-Sales for a company called Recorded Future. So explain a little bit about the company first.
Sure thing. Well, we're a threat intelligence company based up in just outside of Boston, Massachusetts. Offices in D.C., we do a lot of great work with the government. The big idea behind Recorded Future is we structure the open web for analysis, and so we can ask questions like we did in the report, you know, asking, you know, how many government credentials are floating out there on the open web.
All right, and was this company funded by InQtel, or was it part of the intelligence community funding?
Sure. So InQtel is a backer of Recorded Future, as is Google Ventures and many other great investors, and so we've been around since 2009. And one of the key things is, you know, we didn't do this report on behalf of the government or on behalf of any particular organizations. You know, we just did this as a, you know, sort of a great way to illustrate some of the findings by OMB that have already been put out there and findings by a whole variety of reports on security at government agencies.
All right, so in finding these credentials out there, you went to, as you say, the open web. That is to say, you didn't even need to go deep into the deep dark web to find this material.
Sure, and one of the things, the good things to clarify is that, you know, we structure about 680,000 sources from the web. We focused on PACE sites for this particular report. So there were 17 of them that we analyzed from November 2013 till November 2014. And a PACE site is a really, the reason why we focused on that part of the site, that part of the web, is because those are sites that are filled with code. They're really dumping grounds on the web, and they're very hard to analyze. And so we focused on them because that's where oftentimes credentials end up, and that's where we found those likely or possible government credentials.
And so to the uninitiated, if you go to a PACE site, what is pasted in there? And it comes every second, it seems, somebody's pasting something there. It looks like gibberish because it is, in fact, code, correct?
It is. And so pastebin.com is far and away the largest and far and away provided a lot of the results in the report. And, you know, anybody can go to pastebin.com. It's not a sketchy site that you have to worry about going to. It's a very basic site where coders will trade code. It's, you know, you paste and share code into it, and it helps you format it, helps you share it. But because you know, a lot of hackers are former coders, they use these sites to dump emails, passwords, and all sorts of information that they leak from all sorts of different sites. And so, one of the key things that I wanted to call out was that, you know, these are not credentials leaked from government agencies. These are employees using their .gov email addresses on different places on the web to sign up for hotel reviews, to sign up for associations or clubs, you know, sign up for groups that have much less protected websites. And so they're using their government email address to sign up for a site that gets hacked, because hackers usually go after the, you know, the weaker sites. They go after targets of opportunity. And so in using their government email addresses and possibly their government passwords on these sites, that's where a lot of these credentials come from. It's from the third-party sites they're using, not actually using them at work.
So the first mistake they make then is using the same password they use to access their government system at work, to use that password on, I don't know, Hotels by Tonight or something like that.
Exactly. And so we were not.
That's kind of a basic error, right?
It is a basic error. And, you know, there's a combination of, you know, I know your previous the interview, I believe, was Tony Scott that you had on earlier, you know, was talking about some of the security measures. And so it's a combination of some of the lack of implementation of security measures combined with poor operational security by a lot of government employees by using their government email address on sites that, you know, for personal use.
So basically a site like Pastebin, ostensibly, it's like a flea market where people can put out what they have created in the open source community, mostly for honest people, but people mix in their own table among the legitimate flea market vendors, and that's where they put in things that really shouldn't be there. Is that a good analogy?
It's a great way to, you know, it's a nice, free, quick, and easy way to oftentimes a lot of the hackers will just brag about, you know, these are usually hacktivists, you know, there's usually some sort of ostensible cause behind hacking a certain site. And a lot of these government credentials are just caught in the crossfire. They're pulled down just like every other tens of thousands of email addresses, you know, Gmail addresses, Yahoo addresses. It just so happens that they're .gov addresses. But when you do this at scale and you understand how many different sites are hacked each and every single day, it begins to add up. And we found, and I don't think it was in our report, but 705 possible government credentials were found. And so it begins to add up. And if they're all not valid, you only need a few. And then one of the key things in our report was we highlighted that about 50% of Internet users, you know, the numbers range from, you know, about 41 to 55. It depends on the reference. But about half of Internet users reuse the same password for business and professional. And so when you have hundreds of credentials, all you really need are a few to work, considering the poor security practices that a lot of the government agencies detailed elsewhere.
We're speaking with Scott Donnelly. He's director of pre-sales for Recorded Future. And so how did you go about scanning these paste sites? You said there were 17 of them. Just looking for keywords like a .gov type of thing?
So part of how Recorded Future does, it's not very targeted. The goal of the company is really just to structure the open web. And so we just, you know, take what we find and then, you know, then you can query against it. And so this is information that we had actually already collected. And then, you know, obviously seeing some of the recent news and just really trying to understand sort of the scope of the problem, we just did a query it's all publicly available on data.gov. It's all the domains tied to all the government agencies. We did a search, and we identified how many .gov email addresses we found. And then we have a great data science team that can take a look and say, well, is there a password tied to this credential? And we were able to pull out the report sort of after the fact. So it's something that was, you know, sort of already being pulled in, and we were just able to analyze it afterwards.
And so this is how you came to the conclusion that more sites in the government need to use that two-factor authentication, because if somebody has a password for 15 different things and that password is found and it also matches the government credential, then the existence of two factors would make sure that credential could not get a stranger onto the network.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that's, you know, we certainly, you know, we think it's a great report, but we also make very clear that this is very easily made, you know, not a big deal at all. If two-factor authentication, VPNs, PIV cards, I think there was TPM chips previously discussed earlier. So I think, you know, any of those, actually fully implementing that solves a lot of these problems. And, you know, we call out in the report the 12 different federal agencies where privileged users that actually have some type of system access, didn't require two-factor authentication to get in onto their systems. And one of the challenges is that, you know, the federal government pushes telework, especially when there's bad weather, you know, working from home. But a lot of these agencies are not, enacting something as basic as two-factor authentication to make sure that basic safeguards aren't in place.
Now, a lot of the popular sites like Google and all the services they offer and many others like it offer two-factor authentication. You don't need to buy a token or subscribe to anything. All you need to do is have a smartphone. You don't even need that. They'll send you some you can print out and keep in your wallet. And so why is this so hard to implement? Is it because these systems are newer and designed with that in mind, and this can't be retrofitted to systems that might be running, I don't know, COBOL, for example?
Yeah, I'm not sure. You know, it's a bit outside the scope of the report, and I certainly don't want to project too much. You certainly had a great speaker on earlier with some of the ideas on why this wasn't working. I think, you know, there's a variety of different challenges associated with it. You know, bring your device to work issues. You know, if you use two-factor authentication, you know, who provides the device, and then is there some sort of vulnerabilities associated with using, you know, personal phones for this type of thing? So I'm not sure. There's an enormous government workforce, and so there are challenges with implementing. I think there are certainly sort of day one things you can do when you take a look at the fact that privileged users, you know, users that have more than just email access remotely, who don't have two-factor authentication, you know, that seems to me that's something you can very quickly remedy, just to make sure that anybody who has more than remote email access has some type of two-factor authentication or PIV card requirement to access it. So I'm not entirely sure. I think it just comes down to actually implementing what has been laid out there for, it seems like, you know, a year, 18 months in terms of identifying these issues. And so I think it very much, they know what they need to do. It just comes down to actually implementing the changes that they've already laid out in multiple reports.
And in the large corporations that the company, your company, deals with, is it common for them to require access with two factors for network administrators and people with other privileged access?
Oh, sure. And particularly some of the adopters of, you know, our tool, you know, scans the open web for discussions of things that can impact them. If they're already at that point where they're, using a tool to go out and look for, see who's discussing their network or who's discussing their credentials or their IP addresses, if they're at that point, then, you know, most times they've already moved past that and they've begun to implement two-factor and things that we've already discussed.
And if people want to examine the unopen web, the part that's hard to get to, are there tools to do that also?
There are tools to do that, and that it does almost become a sort of a custom job, because when you're getting into the, Recorded Future does a great job in the surface web and the deep web, and the dark web is certainly an area a lot of organizations are beginning to push to. But the dark web is certainly much more targeted. Certainly there are certain marketplaces and there are certain areas of the web where things are sold. And so the challenge in dealing with, you know, open source information for like threat intelligence or cyber threats is that it's so scattered amongst social media, it's scattered amongst blogs and pay sites and all sorts of different forums and across languages. But when you get to the dark web, it's much more relationship-driven. It's much harder to get to. You have to use things like Tor to get to it. There's a lot of legality issues in dealing with the dark web, so it's very challenging. And I think what was most alarming about this case was that this was on the open web and that it didn't require somebody who has a little bit more knowledge of using something like a Tor to get onto the dark web. This is something that any user can just log into right now.
All right. Scott Donnelly is the Director of Pre-Sales for Recorded Future. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.